said you can kill my body, but you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with Paul Street. He's a history instructor at DePaul University. He writes for Counterpunch, and he's a member of an organization called Refuse Fascism. I've also read things in the past that he's written for the Black Agenda Report. He's written a number of books, the most recent of which, and a focus for right now, is called Hollow Resistance, Obama, Trump, and the Politics of Appeasement. Paul has also written some very interesting books that I've read over the years. They Rule, the 1% versus Democracy, The Emperor's New Clothes, Barack Obama in the Real World of Power. And even before Obama was elected in 2007, I remember that's where I became acquainted with your work. It was Barack Obama and the Future of American Politics. He's a very, very lucid writer about political and economic phenomena, and it's great to be with you again today, Paul. I've always enjoyed our conversations and really admired your work.
Thanks so much, Rob, and greetings from downtown Chicago. It's a beautiful October day here.
And my dad was from Riverside out by the Brookfield Zoo, so I used to go to Chicago as a little guy and go to the zoo and go to Cubs games and things like that. So Chicago's cool.
I'm White Sox, but Brookfield Zoo, I remember that very well. I've been there.
So here we are in the middle of a pandemic. The whole world's been put on notice, unmasking that many things aren't right. I think people could sense things were a little off course or a great deal off course. Social sustainability, changing our environmental structure, the excesses of finance, automation, machine learning, and the future of work. All of these things are what you might call fuels of the engines of despair.
Right.
But I'm curious what you think, what you're seeing, where you see the world, I would say, the diagnosis of what the pandemic means, what it is unmasked, and I don't know, just where you'd like to see things go.
Well, you know, I've been, as a journalist, very immersed in specifically the Trump era, the last few years. That's why at first I was kind of feeling kind of weird about writing a book, another one that had Obama in the title, though I'm glad I did, and it didn't stop me from focusing on the Trump era. And the tale and the story of the horrors of the Trump years is almost overwhelming. It's like a blitzkrieg. I've shared this with a number of other progressive and left writers and journalists. There's almost a sense of not being able to keep up. I mean, in the minute you've got one horror story told, you know, you have Lafayette Square, Kenosha, Portland, so, you know, the killing of Soleimani. I mean, the list goes on. The news cycle's already obsolete, and we're on to a next horror, and we're in the middle of one of those mind-bending news cycles right now with Trump having COVID. And you get so immersed in the current events that, thank God I have training in history. That's my original trade, my original field. That you can forget that the Trump nightmare, neo-fascist, if you want to call it that, white nationalist, authoritarian, was not hatched overnight. This is an outcome of decades. Some folks I know would say centuries of historical development. I'm not going to go centuries for our purposes here, though there are connections back to the Old South and the Jim Crow era, I think, with Trump. But anyway, this is in many ways the outcome of the last 40 to 50 years, the neoliberal era, this situation when we're right now, the discrediting of democratic and progressive ideals, ideals, unfortunately, often by Democrats like Barack Obama and before him, of course, the Clintons. This kind of neoliberal captivity, this kind of corporate takeover, what Sheldon, the late Sheldon Wolin, called Democracy Incorporated, of the leftmost of the, you know, we have a binary political system. That's a problem, but it's a reality. And the takeover of the leftmost of those two parties tends to discredit democratic ideals and people's faith in things like hope and change, the things that Obama ran on. But actually, those keywords were campaign keywords were taken from the Bill Clinton 92 campaign. Tends to render people cynical and atomized and demobilized, and this in turn opens the door for a GOP that just seems, with every election cycle, to move further and further and further to the right. Nixon was obviously horrible, but he was still sort of part of the New Deal era in many ways. Reagan moved further right, Bush moved further right, and now we've gone into this kind of very disastrous kind of space, which many of us on the left think it's now sort of accurate to describe as fascistic or neo-fascist, certainly white nationalist, certainly authoritarian. Now, curiously enough, Obama will never use those words, certainly not the F word, in public. There's a big disconnect with Obama that I wrote this last book about, between what he says publicly and what he believes privately. But one of the very most interesting things I found as I was writing Hollow Resistance is that we found out from a Hillary Clinton documentary film that came out earlier this year that Obama had said to Tim Kaine in October of 2016 as the election was nearing. And by the way, Hillary, about this time in October of 2016, Hillary Clinton had a double-digit lead over Donald Trump. And I say that because I just saw a news story on CNN that Joe Biden has a double-digit lead over Donald Trump. But in any event, Obama said to Tim Kaine, Hillary's vice presidential candidate, you know, you better get it together because we've got to stop a fascist, says Obama's word, from going into the White House. Well, within less than a month, Obama is walking out into the Rose Garden, privately believing that the guy who's just won is an arch authoritarian and a menace and a grave menace to humanity, but publicly saying, hey, let's not get too all upset here because we're all Americans first, and this is just an intramural battle, and so on and so forth. And I'm confident that I've handed on the baton of democracy and freedom and justice to my successor, and that he is also going to want to make this country a more perfect union, to use sort of Obama's language. And around the same time, he's telling 4 years ago, this is kind of haunting now to think about this now, and he's telling David Remnick, the brilliant editor of The New Yorker, he's saying to him and also to his younger staffers in the White House, hey, it's not the apocalypse. I think Obama's phrase was, I don't believe in the apocalypse until the apocalypse comes, which I find ironic because writing this book, The Hollow Resistance, you know, 3+ years later, I sort of, one of the tensions in there is like, hey, Obama, are we there yet? Is that happening? Have we got there? And I started that before COVID even hit. I started writing this book before COVID was happening, which sort of takes things to another level. And there's this bizarre kind of dangerous synergy between this horrific pandemic, which itself is not just hatched by Trump, though Trump has clearly fanned it and fueled it and disseminated it in profoundly grotesque and arguably even sort of genocidal racist kinds of ways. But the pandemic, like other pandemics of this century, is in many ways an outcome of an out-of-control globalization, which pushes humanity and commerce ever deeper into parts of global ecology that we shouldn't be pushing into. And then, of course, thanks to neoliberal global hyper-capitalism, can disseminate viruses across time zones and across world systemic zones in a, you know, in the flash of a second. So here we are with this sort of arch-authoritarian, far-right president waging open war, well, on just so many things, on women's rights, on black rights, on immigrant rights, on animal rights, on livable ecology, on nuclear arms control agreements. This is a hidden story that it's just because there's so much in the Trump era that people don't talk about that one enough. And on the constitutional electoral process itself, so that we really have an endangered quadrennial. I've never been a particularly great fan of the American electoral process and the narrow spectrums in its binary nature, but this is different. This is like we've got a guy who's telegraphing. I mean, I don't know what his diagnosis means for that now yet. I haven't processed it, but here's a guy who's been telegraphing an open assault on the electoral process, and oddly enough and perversely enough, the pandemic that he has helped fan. I mean, we're 5% of the world's population, and we have more of the fifth of the cases and deaths in the world. And this pandemic that he has helped fan is perversely enough part of the electoral assault in a way, because he's attacking the mail-in ballots that are required precisely by his pandemic, and counting on the pandemic to work in such a way as to give him an election night victory, and then he wants to discredit the mail-in ballots after that, and all of that, and now he's got it himself, which is just, it's just astonishing. I was wondering if that was going to happen, and then I gave up on thinking it was going to happen, and then all of a sudden, it happened. My feeling about where we're headed is that that this 13-point lead or thereabouts that Biden has, and I'm not very excited about Biden, but because of, well, let me digress a little, because of the awfulness of Trump, I'm doing something this election cycle that I usually don't do. I'm usually almost always a third party voter. I tend to be fairly alienated from the quote unquote corporate Democrats. I certainly was alienated from Obama on the basis of my knowledge of him from Chicago and Illinois, even before he became a national phenomenon. But this is an election cycle in which I feel no choice but to vote for the Democratic candidate, even in a safe state, because Illinois is reliably blue. But it strikes me that Trump's chance of being able to steal this thing, both constitutionally and extra-constitutionally, will go down if Biden has a good electoral college margin and also a popular vote margin. I actually think the overall national popular vote is going to work. So I'm going to do that, and I'm telling people, yeah, you should. My God, you should take 2 minutes to try and get rid of this thing, you know, this apocalyptic white nationalist arch-authoritarian in the White House who I don't think he's joking when he says he wants to be president for life. But I also think that's insufficient. I think that's going to be insufficient. I think voting isn't in and of itself is not going to do it. I think we are headed to some sort of constitutional crisis or complication. I mean, all indications are that we are. The people who study this, the Transition Integrity Project that's been running all these sort of top-down scenarios and different outcomes, say that's happening, barring a full-on total Biden sweep, which strikes me as unlikely for various reasons, including voter suppression and just sort of the inadequacy of Biden as a candidate. I don't see him sweeping completely. I hope he does, but I don't see it. And therefore, I think there'll be another kind of fight that will have to be fought by the people in the streets, mass mobilizations, such as occurs in other countries. I think to wrap this long answer to your brief question up, I think Americans need to be a little less exceptionalist and think more about themselves in relationship to the political experience in other countries. We sort of have to get over this notion that a really authoritarian nationalist regime could never happen here. You know, that can't happen. Well, it's kind of been happening. It's not just Trump's fault. This is rooted in our institutions. And it kind of broke out in 2016 and has been happening the last 3 years. And we probably have to also think about the kind of mobilizations beyond just 2 minutes in a voting booth or doing a mail-in ballot once every 1,460 days. I think we're going to have some street pressure, nonviolent mass mobilization and resistance. And I think we can do that. People are not going to put up, in fact, with the cherished American electoral process being violated by Trump. And I think when we do respond to that in ways that send a message to the many agents within the wealth and power elite in this country that don't like Trump, they have their own reasons. They're different than ours for not liking Trump. And they can, in fact, with some big help from popular pressure, act to make sure that he leaves. Then I hope and pray and will work for the possibility that we have set a precedent of popular power beyond just voting. Voting matters, but beyond just voting and social movements in the streets, in the workplaces, and elsewhere, that can actually make this kind of dismal neoliberal corporate, not very inspiring candidate, Biden, feel compelled to do some decent things that we need done. I already feel good about him being much better on the virus. I believe him when he says he will have a national mask requirement. Good for him. But I mean even more than that, and perhaps expand Medicare and bring down the age for Medicare and push him to get serious about re-legalizing union organizing. And we would want to push him for a green job programs and all of that. If he doesn't want to do that, he's going to have to get the heck out of the way. But nothing happens without people mobilized beyond electoral politics, both within and beyond. And that's what I'm hoping for. I hope we can help push Trump out both within and beyond the ballot box, and then use that as a educational and organizational and mobilized presence to push Biden to the left, which would help us prevent a return of these far right-wing Republicans in 2022 and 2024. I don't know that the Democrats really know how to fight Trump and do the things that we want them to do without us pressuring them to do so. And if they don't, they got to get out of the way. That's my very long-winded answer to your question.
Well, I think you're touching on a number of very important themes. I remember in 2016 watching Trump mow down roughly 15 Republicans before defeating Hillary Clinton and talking about how the system was rigged. Talking about how the people had to rise up against all this corruption, etc. And I'm from Detroit originally, and I was in Detroit planning a conference on race and inequality 3 days after the election. But on election day, I was there. And many of my friends, many of whom stayed in Detroit, but many had like advanced degrees, very successful professional careers, told me they were going to vote for Donald Trump because they had lost faith in the Democratic Party after NAFTA, criminal justice reform, welfare reform, etc. And they saw essentially Michigan going down the tubes. And they told me that, you know, maybe I lived in my family and children all lived on the East Coast, and that I didn't feel it, but they watched Donald Trump come to the Detroit Economic Club and scold the management right after he got the nomination, scold the management of the big three auto companies for losing American jobs in the United States. Right. And so at some level, I guess what I'm getting at with that story is there was a despair, a rising despair, maybe related to globalization, automation, Sure. Austere state and local budgets, what have you. But people didn't, after 8 years of Obama, particularly in that kind of white working class group, did not have faith in the Democratic Party. The traditional New Deal to Lyndon Johnson's Great Society coalition had been decimated by what some people called a DLC strategy of raising money and substituting identity politics for economic interest as the agenda. And so I look at it now, and what people of that ilk, people like Bob Borsage and others who I know from Washington, are concerned about is that if the Biden is victorious, if the Democratic modus operandi doesn't change profoundly, we will be deepening the despair and preparing for, I don't want to call it the next Trump, but another nightmarish episode. And yet, I guess I'm going to ask you, if in the first 100 days, what policy agenda would you like to see to inspire America out of this dread and despondency and to think we were getting back onto a sustainable track?
Yeah, well, you listen, I hear you. And I've been sent a few pieces recently by friends indicating strongly that Biden's economic team is quite neoliberal and saying things like, well, you know, when we get in there, the cupboard's going to be bare and we won't be able to do very much in the way of stimulus and expansion and protection of people. And that's just death. That's really chilling, because to me, that spells exactly what you're afraid of and what you're talking about, and opens the door to a kind of Tea Party style congressional comeback for the right-wing Republicans in 2022. And then God knows who their candidate is in 2024, but probably someone with much the same sort of white backlash, nationalist base and orientation, but maybe a little smarter than Trump. And I think of somebody like Tom Cotton. I don't know if he's viable or not, but on top of being in that same scary, chilly authoritarian space, I think Tom Cotton called for invoking the Insurrection Act during the George Floyd rebellion, you know, also be quite articulate and actually able to read policy papers from the Heritage Foundation and the American Enterprise Institute, which, you know, Trump can't or won't. He doesn't have the patience or ability to read it more than two sentences, you know, and so the next Trump could actually be a scarier Trump, or it could be somebody else. You know, people know more about right-wing Republican politics than I do. Throw some names at me and I have to research them. You know, in terms of the first 100 days, I guess I would wish for something in line with the candidate that Obama helped Biden defeat in 2020, which is Bernie Sanders. And that would include is very significant. And of course, you'd have to have victories in the House and the Senate as well for progressives, or at least somewhat progressive, or the types of Democrats who might be able to be influenced by them. Very serious progressive taxation, Green New Deal, serious green jobs programs, which would simultaneously like help us save the possibility of life on Earth, and also at the same time provide a heck of a lot of decent livable wage and better than just livable wage jobs for millions of people. Re-legalization of union organizing. Now, Obama campaigned in 2008 on card check union authorization, on the Employee Free Choice Act, basically to turn the National Labor Relations Board back into an agent of unionization. Most Americans would rather that their jobs were unionized and under collective bargaining agreements than not, and that's for some pretty good reasons, because they may know, or at least heard from their parents and grandparents, that unions created a middle class in this country. So re-unionization and, you know, of course, crush the virus. I mean, I hate to use Nancy Pelosi's language, but the virus must be crushed. This is embarrassing and disgusting and chilling and horrifying that we have a fifth of the planet's coronavirus virus cases. I mean, it's just pathetic, and there needs to be leadership from the top down, including a national mask mandate and the invocation of the National Production Defense Act to create enough. I mean, we could well be in the middle of a worsening pandemic by next January 20th. A willingness to immediately invoke Defense Production Act to shift resources to medical protective equipment and a national testing program. I mean, I've heard it said recently that the White House itself is going to have more COVID cases than the whole nation of New Zealand. I don't know if that's true, but you know, that kind of sums up our dilemma in that regard. So I guess the Bernie Sanders agenda is part of what I'd like to see. I mean, you know, I'd like to see more radical structural change than all of that, but just for starters, to try and get back on a decent track. I would add also that Obama, a lot of the language you hear about Obama and the working class, the white working class, he demobilized the working class in the Rust Belt. I think that's true. The voting data, and I've gone into this in some detail with a number of social scientists I know. It's interesting. The Trump base is much less white, much less working class and proletarian than it is commonly said to be. It actually tends to be sort of relatively petty bourgeois and actually slightly more affluent than the Clinton base in 2016. But what I think Obama did by functioning in essence as the president of Citigroup and the president of JP Morgan Trust and Goldman Sachs and all of that was help demobilize the longstanding majority progressive Democratic Party base. And incidentally, this is where I was going with that, not just the white working class, but also very significantly the black working middle and lower class, which did not come out to vote in the kinds of numbers that the Democrats needed it to in battleground states, Milwaukee and Wisconsin, Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and Pennsylvania, Cleveland and Cincinnati and Ohio, Charlotte and North Carolina, Miami and other cities in Florida. You know, that the states where, thanks to the Electoral College, we really only have a presidential election. And that's a sort of a hidden story about the sort of betrayal of Black America and doing very, very little, if anything, for Black America, which lost wealth and lost net worth dramatically under Obama. This was a presidency, incidentally, where during its first term, Obama, 95% of the nation's new income went to the top 1%. People knew that. They might not have known that statistic, but they experienced that in their kitchen tables, in their bank books. Healthcare premiums continued to be unaffordable. College student debt continued to be insane. You know, yes, there were a lot of jobs created under Obama, but they were bad jobs. They were non-union jobs. They didn't pay well. He expanded offshore oil. I mean, I could go through the whole record of the Obama administration. But among the people that got demobilized included a lot of black people in urban America who were like, okay, we had this super symbolic victory. A black man came to power in the land of cotton slavery, and it didn't translate into much of anything for black America. And they didn't vote for him. Now Trump's base, I'm afraid, was connected mainly by, I've looked at a lot of statistics on this, and polling data and opinion data, solidified mainly by white identity, combined with, in interesting ways, combined with authoritarianism, desire for a strong leader who would smack down the liberals and leftists who are accused absurdly of opening the door up to people of color to cut in line ahead of white people. And all of this with Obama sort of just by virtue of the color of his skin, supposedly proving that blacks have moved ahead of whites and that racism is no longer a problem in America. This was a concern I always had about Obama, that as president, he would be the last nail in the coffin of white America's ability
to see racism as a problem. And in fact, that he as president would provoke a racist backlash that would target poor black people and then he would skip free from because he'd cash in and become a multimillionaire when his presidency was over. Well, that all happened. But and I think those are the main things that have connected the Trump base, not economic populism. But I must say, Trump talked about globalization. He called out Goldman Sachs and General Motors and Citigroup. He called out Hillary accurately for being a tool of elite financial institutions. And he even said more about policy. Forget what policy, just about policy. But Donald Trump said far more about policy than Hillary Clinton did. Hillary Clinton, a policy wonk from Yale Law, ran on candidate character and how awful Trump was. She just thought that how awful Trump was and character would be enough to carry her to victory, which is just this critical mistake. There's an absolutely brilliant essay that done by Joel Ferguson and some other people at your institute, Center for New Economic. I'm sorry, I don't want to mispronounce the name of your organization, but the wonderful paper that documents precisely that she didn't talk about policy, and Trump actually did. He talked about tariffs and cutting back globalization and all that. He didn't mean it. He's not an economic populist. I mean, my God, he got in there and the only real thing he passed in his first year in was a massive tax cut for the wealthy few.
In some respects, you had talked about hope and change that was not realized under Obama, and under Trump, it was the system is rigged. And then what did he do? He feathered the beds of the riggers. And so I watch Trump now with, how do I say, that perhaps artful diagnosis by calling the system rigged, but his remedies were a seduce and abandon kind of ritual. And what concerns me now is that rather than, how I say, addressing the kind of things in your book, 1% versus democracy, he's resorting to what I'll call counter-identity politics of a very ugly variety to try to hold his position with a very, very ugly, dark, and authoritarian agenda associated with it. But I as I was listening to you describe Hillary Clinton's candidacy as been about identity and the problems of, how hideous Trump's personality was,
right. It
reminds me that I did a podcast with Bob Borisage right after the Democratic virtual convention. And he essentially said, I watched 3 days of people just telling us how bad Trump was. They weren't telling us what they learned from the Obama years that inspired the country to elect Trump and how they've learned from that are going to change course. So they were relying on the negative about the Republican president, not the positive of what they were offering, the magnet. And my concern kind of relates again to my experience in Detroit, where one gentleman said to me, when there's nothing in the restaurant you want to eat, you don't go to the restaurant. And the turnout in Detroit in 2016 was off by roughly 120,000 relative to 2012.
And that's an 80% black city.
That's right. 78% black city. And the population, not the registered voters, is only about 780,000 people. And you're sitting there saying 122,000 stayed home. And at some level, I guess the lesson I'm encouraging is for the Biden campaign to answer the question I asked you. What are you going to do in the first 100 days? Foreshadow how we're going to change course. And there are elements of improvement there. But I think the scope and the scale And a little bit the, what you might call, ability to go to confession. We didn't do enough. We bailed out the financiers because we were frightened and it was a panic, etc. And it was handed to us by Paulson and Bush. So the architecture was largely established. But we didn't do mortgage reform for lots of people who were underwater. So there just feels to me like a missing magnet on the Democratic side as we approach this time.
One of the most absolutely disgusting parts of the first year of the Obama administration was the all-out assault on single-payer national health insurance, which right now has support. And it's not surprising, I think, because of the pandemic. It's always had majority support, but now it's seven in 10 Americans who support single-payer national health insurance. And with Obama, it was so cold that his own personal doctor and close friend, Dr. Quentin Young from my old neighborhood of Hyde Park on the south side of Chicago, wasn't even invited to the national conference that he had on healthcare in 2009. And of course, that was just a replay of the S show that was Hillary Clinton's healthcare national conference that she called in 1993 with the single payer people kicked to the curb. I don't know how we call ourselves a democracy. You know, I keep hearing, well, our great democracy is in danger right now. When you've got 7 in 10 Americans support single payer health insurance, and it's off the table of the presidential binary options on the presidential debate. And in fact, we had Biden, I believe it was last year, maybe it was this year, announced that he would, or at least suggest that he would veto Medicare for All if it came to his desk. Now, I have heard hopeful things about Biden being willing to move towards bringing the age of, this would benefit me, bringing the age of Medicare down, which would be a good thing. That'd be fine. The furthest down we could push that, Medicare is a single-payer healthcare system. That'd be okay. But I never know whether to believe that, because I remember Obama playing games with the public option and then researchers finding out that it was never serious at all, that he was going to try and add a public option into his healthcare mix. And it turned out he never had any intention of doing that. But that would be something that would be very important. You know, Obama, ex-President Obama, actually had the chutzpah just a few months into his ex-presidency to go to the John Fitzgerald Kennedy Presidential Library in Boston and get a Profiles in Courage Award, in which he, in his acceptance speech, he said, you know, it doesn't take any courage to make policy in accord with the desires of the wealthy few. I mean, it was almost exactly that language. I'm paraphrasing. Well, it was the exact trajectory and direction of his presidency, which is part of why he has a $65 million book contract and flies, you know, and goes around on yachts with Richard Branson and David Geffen and is on the, and has a Netflix contract and is looking forward to becoming an NBA part owner. I mean, I'm sorry if I sound jaundiced and cynical there, but that's the delayed payoff for, you know, I've got a whole chapter about that in my book. That's the delayed payoff for that 8 year. And he also went to the Chicago Economic Club, talking about municipal economic clubs, in December of 2017. And at one point, a black female CEO of Ariel Capital Management says to him, there's a lot of danger afoot right now with this current president, you know, this authoritarian Donald Trump. What should we do? And Obama says, well, you have to be very careful. I'll never forget this. You have to be very careful. You have to tend to this garden of democracy, he says. And he says, if you don't, we could end up like Vienna in the 1920s. So he's referencing Weimar Germany, the rise of fascism. And he says, if you're not careful, if you don't tend to this garden of democracy, it can all collapse very quickly. And then he says, look what happened in Germany and Austria. And before you know it, 60 million people died. And it's like, oh, okay. That's exactly what he did not do during his presidency. Precisely
tending to this garden of democracy was the opposite of the Obama presidency, and that's why his base didn't see much reason and didn't find liberal promises of Democrats to be very authentic, and didn't and in 2016 and were at least willing to not go out. A lot of his base went, what the hell? And there were white working class people in former Obama voting districts and precincts and sometimes in blue collar areas, particularly where they've had plant closings in Pennsylvania and Ohio, that said, yeah, give this crazy guy, I don't really like how he behaves, but let's give him a shot, shake things up. He sounds like he wants to be a revolutionary or something. Well, of course he didn't. It's like you say, seduce and abandon. And Obama's rhetoric as an ex-president is so disingenuous about how he was as a president. And, you know, when people woke up to that fact, young people in particular, always sort of the canaries in the mine. And incidentally, Joe Biden is on record saying he has no empathy for millennials and their struggle into this neoliberal economy. But that's an aside. When young people rose up with Occupy in this remarkable moment for 2 weeks in the late summer and early fall of 2011, and the country lit up like a cell phone map with Occupy camps from coast to coast, is really quite extraordinary. I actually saw Zuccotti Park, and then I saw the Occupy attempts here in Chicago, and there was even one out in Iowa City where I was living. It was just incredible. And Obama and his Democratic allies in cities across the country and Obama's Department of Homeland Security acted to infiltrate, surveil, and ultimately contribute in some ugly ways, in some cases, to the dismantlement of that remarkable moment, which I give a lot of credit for putting the idea of the 1% of the 99% into the national political rhetoric. A lot of Bernieites don't agree with me, but I think the Occupy created a context for Bernie. And it doesn't get enough credit. It gets thrown down the memory hole. And it was a remarkable movement, all too short-lived, had all kinds of problems. But Obama participated in its dismantlement, which helps create the discrediting and the disillusionment and the demobilization that opens the door for a Trump.
Let me kind of stay in this place, but shift focus slightly. The role of money in electoral politics, lobbying for appointments, enforcement, legislative design, regulatory structures, coupled with a very highly concentrated distribution of wealth and income, and coupled with corporate personhood, makes it very hard for anyone to enact the kind of things that Bernie Sanders, in a very healthy way, aspires to bring about. I mean, there are healthcare systems that are much less expensive in other parts of the world that, according to the World Health Organization, perform much better than the American one. So these are not all just what you might call utopian fantasies. But it concerns me, I guess, to say, and I follow the lead of my research director at INET, Tom Ferguson, that it's all about failed personality. When in some respects, anybody who wants to survive in either party needs to sell policy in order to raise the money. And the other problem, of course, is incumbents all get an edge relative to challengers because challengers can't sell policy. They don't have the right yet. In other words, as they're building their war chest. Right. So when I look at the illness, let's say Obama was just as you said, and one night we had a spaceship, Star Trek, and it dropped in Bernie Sanders. He still has to work with that Congress. And can his visionary value leadership actually be translated into policies unless we form reform and transform the structure of our political system, which itself is a legislative act that's hard to imagine being realized.
Yeah, boy, those are great questions. You know, when people talk about the role of money in politics, they often restrict their discussion to the very important topic of campaign finance, which is obviously like a really big deal, particularly as elections become so expensive that they've gone into the stratosphere. And there's a congressman right now who used to be a law student at Yale, Raskin, wrote a wonderful law review article back in the 90s. I'll never forget it because it was one of my first, when I sort of crossed over from history into social policy research, one of my first assignments was campaign finance. And he talked about the wealth primary. And he said, you don't have, which is his analogy to the old white primary in the Democratic Party in the South. He said, you don't have any chance for running for office unless you yourself have personal wealth or you have access to people who have personal wealth that can help you pay for these campaigns. And we have two court decisions that a lot of people, you know, who aren't insiders on campaign finance don't really know very much about. But between Buckley Valeo, which I think was 1975, and Citizens United, which was 2010, money is speech. And the Supreme Court, the appointed for life, constitutionally ordained Supreme Court says so, that money is speech. And under Citizens United, it's almost unlimited. I mean, you have to be clever about how you do it, but there's an unlimited voice now for money, you know, and well, everyone has free speech. It's just that rich people have a megaphone that's about 3,000 times more powerful than I have on a street corner. I'm out here trying to hand out flyers, you know, to get people to a demonstration, and that's nothing compared. But it isn't just campaign finance. It's media ownership, really critical in determining the viability of any candidate. I mean, I really was concerned about if Sanders got the nomination, not only would a lot of campaign finance, if he got the Democratic nomination, not only would a lot of campaign finance money that would normally have gone to a Democrat end up floating back to Trump in 2020, but also he would be beaten up and trashed by the supposedly liberal left cable news networks like MSNBC and CNN. It would have been quite an interesting experiment to see where they would have gone if Sanders had been the nominee. So media ownership is another mechanism of money influence, the offering of jobs to people in elected office and other public offices and jobs for their families during and after elected officials' time in office is really big. And from what I hear from some research, it's become more and more of a mechanism of elite control, right? Do two or three terms in the House of Representatives. I don't know, what do they make, $165,000 a year? Do nice things for elite financial institutions and corporations while you're there with the understanding that you will make your real money when you rotate out of Congress and take a lobbying position or a consultancy position. All of that, also the staffing of senators' offices and certainly the White House by people directly out of elite financial and corporate institutions and their think tanks. You know, so you have an Obama administration and certainly a Biden administration will be full of people from Goldman Sachs, from Citigroup, from J.P. Morgan Trust, Wells Fargo, maybe having rotated through some of the elite policymaking think tanks like the Brookings Institution and the Center for American Progress and, you know, the granddaddy of them all, the Council on Foreign Relations, which used to be headed by the head of by Robert Rubin when he was also the CEO of Goldman Sachs. I always thought that was like their ultimate ruling class trifecta, Goldman Sachs, economic advisor to Obama and Council on Foreign Relations. So it's more than campaign finance. And changing that and fixing that damn near strikes me as on the scale of a constitutional amendment
which among other things would rewire our electoral system. I mean, this is constitutional amendments are very difficult, you know, but I know a number of law professors and others who actually think and write and converse with one another very seriously about what a democracy might look like, and full public financing would be a key part of a democracy amendment in this country of elections, just full public financing of elections, and something in the way of proportional representation, if we are serious about letting other parties become players in American politics like they are in other modern industrial capitalist democratic societies. Right now, they're not. Most Americans say that both of the two parties that we have do not adequately represent the spectrum of opinion in this country, and they're right about that. But third parties aren't players. I also don't get real excited about third party voting, because we do have a binary electoral system, and a lot of it's kind of rooted in the very nature and the very structure constitutionally of our winner take all electoral college. Just the electoral college would have to go. I mean, to do something fun sometime, talk to people from another country and try and explain the American electoral college system to them. And they just, their eyes pop out of their head. And they're like, what? That's right. Person from France, person from Germany, person from Australia. We do not directly popularly elect the president of the United States of America. It's just astonishing. You know, the overrepresentation of the rightmost parts of the country, the most rural, whitest, reactionary, white-most parts of the country in the U.S. Senate and via that also in the Electoral College. It's mind-boggling. It's just astonishing. So California has 39 million people and has two U.S. senators. Wyoming, I think it is, has 540,000 people or thereabouts, and they have two U.S. senators. I mean, there are real structural changes required. Some things you don't have to do a constitutional amendment for, and frankly, I think if Biden gets in, that he's going to, there's nothing in the Constitution that prevents him from actually expanding the Supreme Court. I would add that to my list of things that I think we would want to press a Biden administration to do. He should do that. We cannot be saddled with a very far right-wing Supreme Court for the next 30 or 40 years. We won't have a chance of doing anything for Black lives or women lives or livable ecology or gay and transgendered lives. I mean, it's just a veto on everything progressive and decent that we need to move forward as a civilization.
Paul, you teach history. Young people today come into your classroom. What history books do you offer to them to study times past, but illuminates the challenges on the horizon for us?
Well, you know, lately I've been given the history of Chicago all the time, but I used to have American history surveys. I am a believer in a core textbook. Kids complain about textbooks, but the only thing worse than having a textbook is not having one, because if you think the French Revolution came before the American Revolution, you're just really screwed up, you know. And, if you don't understand the Constitution came after the Declaration of Independence, you got a problem. So you got to have the facts. But nothing has ever topped in terms of the counter text, even to this day. Nothing has ever countered Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. There's some problems with Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States from an elite academic perspective. Like my subfield that I was in academically was labor history and industrial relations. And, you know, I find certain things wrong, and any specialist could find, particularly in the earlier parts of the book. A lot of the early stuff's a little bit off, but nothing has ever matched the People's History of the United States by Zinn in terms of starting dialogue. And that's really critical, something that tells a story. That's very, very good. There's also some people started using a really interesting book called Lies My High School History Teacher Told Me, believe it or not. I mean, kind of neat in an intro U.S. history survey to attack high school history. Historians will tell you, and I don't know that any other academic will tell you this, historians will often tell you that they start with nothing coming out of high school, absolutely nothing. In fact, not only do they start with nothing, they often have to undo high school history. But that's not because history can't be taught well at the K-12 level. I used to teach for years at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb and also at Illinois Institute of Technology in the western suburbs of Chicago. And every once in a while, you get these kids that were really, really adept and knew history. It's almost like they had college-level U.S. survey history before they got there. That's because they went to St. Charles High or Homewood Flossmoor High School. So they had Joey Wegwert, who was a product of a left-wing history department called Northern Illinois used to be. And you can challenge kids. You can challenge them from junior high on to think critically about the past. It's just most high schools, unlike Joey, high school history is taught by the hockey coach or the football coach, and it's just memorization, and it's very, very boring. For disabusing kids of racist ideas and helping them overcome this just chronic indifference to and ignorance about the Black experience, I would say that in survey classes, nothing ever came close for the first half of the survey to the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, by Frederick Douglass. It's just an extraordinarily powerful document written in the first person from like what it was like to be a slave and how he fought back, because Douglass fights back and everybody loves that because that's what slaves should have done. They accuse slaves of being too passive. Why do they put up with it? So you got this whole remarkable story of what slavery was like. And for the second half, for modern U.S. history, of course, now we're getting so far along that I think the surveys are being broken up into thirds. But for the second half, I've never found anything better than Richard Wright's memoir, A Black Boy, which is an autobiographical memoir of powerfully written of what the Jim Crow South was like and then what the Great Migration was like, because he comes to Chicago. And it's just an absolutely brilliant, again, first person. Novels are very good for situating, and memoirs. Novels and memoirs are very good for situating people in eras. So I don't know. Those are some of the things I've assigned. But for the countertext, we still haven't beat Zinn. I think it still stands there. It was a great accomplishment what Howard did when he wrote that book.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of bases today, and I want to thank you for being on the air and sharing your perspective, your reading lists, and your insights about recent presidents and prospective future presidents with our listeners. Do you have any final thoughts you'd like to impart to the audience before we adjourn?
Yeah, vote, but get ready to do more than vote. I think it's going to take more this time. I really do. And then get in the streets, stay in the streets, and stay either way. When I say get in the streets and get ready to, I'm not talking about tearing stuff up. I'm talking about peaceful, nonviolent, real resistance. When Obama says the best way to protest is to vote, I always say, no, the best way to protest is to vote. And we seem to be in an election cycle this time around where we're going to have to protest and mobilize and organize beyond the ballot box, even to have a decent vote.
Street says to stay in the streets. Right. I'm quite, stay in the streets. I'm inspired.
Yeah, and
stay with and Paul Street just, and stay just, in the streets.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I got the right name for that, don't I? And not just to put Biden in and say, oh, everything's okay now. No. Biden is a centrist. He's center right. He's going to have to be pushed. And all these fascists that are out there, I hate to say it, but all these white nationalists and all these people, something's going to have to be done with and about them. And they're not going to just disappear because their dear leader gets potentially defeated and finally agrees to leave during this, I don't know, month-long election that we're coming to.
Yeah. Well, it reminds me of the story, and I don't know if it's true or not, about Lyndon Johnson and Martin Luther King, where Lyndon Johnson knew that the things that were required were difficult, and he said to Dr. King, make me do it.
Yeah.
And it sounds like that's what you're asking of the American people, to make the prospective Biden administration rise to the challenge and create very profound transformation in the quality of life that has been found wanting in recent years. At any rate, thank you for joining me. I hope to have you back again, perhaps after the election.
Absolutely.
And I would encourage everybody to read your new book, Hollow Resistance. I know the people at Counterpunch are very enthusiastic about it. I've been following their website, and I had a chance to read it this last weekend, and it's tremendous food for thought. So thanks again.
Absolutely.
And we'll talk again soon. And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountain so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.